Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. We're gonna read up on a lot of plays and talk about them in many ways. So welcome to the show. Welcome to the show.
You are most welcome, masters. Welcome all to Read More Plays, the comedy podcast of Plays and Processes Artistical. I am your host, Jennifer Sassaman.
And I'm Ricardo Frederick Evans. I'm glad to see thee well. Welcome, good friends.
And let us once again assail your ears with this week's early modern English play by the most renowned chronicler of old, the great and bawdy bard, William Shakespeare. And Mary, our play is Hamlet, the Dane.
Hamlet is often regarded as the best play of all time in the English language, topping many best dramatic works lists in the number one spot again and again.
Can I just say, it is not easy to write an iambic pentameter. Dang.
But you did great. Good job, buddy.
Thank you.
Every season, we compare a classic text with a contemporary adaptation. In season one, we read Guan Hanxing's classic Chinese text, The Injustice to Dou E, and its modern interpretation, Snow in Midsummer, by Francis Yachiu Kaoeg.
In season two, we read the medieval morality tale, Everyman, by Anonymous, and Brandon Jacob Jenkins' Pulitzer Prize finalist play, Everybody. Then last season, we read the Italian Commedia dell'arte romp, A Servant of Two Masters, and its modern adaptation, One Man, Two Governors, which I have to say, I think is one of the funniest plays of all time.
And here we are in season four.
Woo-hoo!
I really wanted to read James Imes' Tony Award-nominated play, Fat Ham, but before we can get to that amazing play, we have to look at the behemoth, Hamlet, by William Shakespeare.
Oof. Buckle up, y'all. We might be here a while. Like,
get some drinks, some snacks, make sure you stay hydrated.
In the past, we've done the pairings of these classic and contemporary plays in a single episode, but since Hamlet is approximately 759 hours long, we have broken this conversation into two episodes. This week, we'll be talking about the classic, and next episode will be the contemporary and the comparison. But Ricardo, we cannot avoid it any longer.
No!
We are going to start Hamlet, though by start, I really mean tell everyone the content warning, which is this. Pretty much everyone in this play dies.
Spoiler alert.
Hamlet has a great deal of murder of and by family members. It shows the loss of siblings and parents. There are people struggling with mental health issues and people who use mental health issues as a means to investigate crimes. There is depression and suicide. There are also ghosts, if that's triggering for you, as well as rich people inserting themselves into the actor's process and people jumping into open graves.
And pirates.
It's true, but you don't see the pirates, so you should be okay on that front. This play is so freaking extra.
We know for some of you that these could be upsetting, so if you are sticking around for the conversation, now you know they're coming. And if you are just not feeling a play where most of the named characters are not breathing by the end of the show, we completely understand. Next episode, we'll be discussing James Imes' adaptation of the play where everyone dies, Fat Ham. And we look forward to having you back with us again.
And now it's time for the hot takes.
Deedly hot takes. Elizabethan.
You need a loop. Bling, 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 bling. Every episode, we start off answering the same five questions to give you a quick look at our general impressions of the show. Question number one, what do you think is the best thing about this show that so many people say is the best play ever written?
Yeah, that is what I hear. Now, I will say, actually, I do think the legacy of the show is pretty awesome because, yeah, it's kind of unavoidable. Reputation that the play has, its legacy. But I think the best thing really is how quotable it is. There's so many amazing lines in it. and things that, you know, I think a lot of people don't even realize are attributable to Hamlet. So I think that's pretty awesome. What about you?
I think that often shows either have really great characters or a really cool plot or amazing opportunities for spectacle. I think it's rare when a show kind of hits the mark on multiple levels like that. The story is great. The characters are great. The opportunities for performance are so powerful in the show. And the drama, I mean, oh my gosh, there's so much in terms of spectacle that is a part of the theatricality of the show. So the fact that it gives so many different kinds of opportunities for greatness, I think is the best thing about the show.
Lovely. I agree with that too. What do you see as the biggest problem with the text? You only pick one.
So, Ricardo, you and I are DC natives. Yes. Have you ever been in the theater in DC when there's a movie that is set in DC and they show something that's not accurate to DC, like someone runs into the metro yes. in Georgetown, or like they're like in a chase scene at U14th and they run around the corner and they're yes. down at the mall,
Wonder Woman.
And the audience starts booing and yelling at the screen. I love seeing movies in DC, but it's just like that what are you doing? That was me with this read of Hamlet over and over again. In its actual front to back form, I think this play is completely unperformable. If you've seen Hamlet, you've seen what I can only assume was a highly edited and cut down mm-hmm. version. Can you imagine a young playwright bringing this full text as it's printed to the literary director of the National now, like setting aside all the references that would have only been understood by early modern English audiences, you have a character that's supposed to be 18 or so in Act One, but who's in his 30s in Act Four. You have the smartest character in all of the Shakespeare dramatic universe, the SDU. But when two characters he knows are actively trying to kill him, one of whom he's sworn to kill without hesitation the next time he sees him, when they invite him to a casual fencing match, no big deal. He's like, oh, how delightful. Let's see if I can win. That doesn't seem suspicious at all. The play tells us in one line that Horatio, a man who lives in a different country, but is somehow so buddy-buddy with the castle guards that they ask him to come out in the middle of the night to look at ghosts with them. Horatio says that he saw the king of Denmark one time. Then 25 lines later, he says to Hamlet, I knew your father. These hands are not more like the. I just found myself going out of my mind with how inconsistent the play was. Like, the whole point of watching a play is that the audience agrees to willfully suspend its disbelief and just go with the premise of what's happening on stage, like it's real within the story. And the artists are supposed to do their best not to remind the audience that they're living truthfully under those imaginary circumstances, unless they're in a Brecht play. But this play has so many continuity errors and illogical problems that it just doesn't make sense. And I don't think most audiences ever see these issues, because the script does contain within it so many extraordinary performance opportunities, and it gets really heavily edited, so you don't have to deal with. But I think that this script itself is really problematic. And I kept thinking about that quote from Clueless when Ty is looking at Amber and is all like thinking like, is she prettier than me? And Cher says, oh, she's a full-on Monet. It's like a painting. It's like from far away, it's okay, but up close, it's a big old mess. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. I had so many feelings on this read. How about you? What do you think is the biggest problem with the text?
Yeah, as is, it's bloated and it's just, there's just too much of it, and it has to be edited for a contemporary audience, I think. Yeah, I also it's a bit of a sausage party. I mean, you know, there aren't really a lot of great roles for women. I said it.
Again, as written. Yep. What is your favorite quote from the play? Hot take number three. I know that this is epic poetry over and over.
Yeah, mine is, I don't know, maybe it's because I've been an educator or an acting teacher or whatever, but I just love the direction that he gives the players. And I'm like, that's speak it. That's speech. Exactly it. Like, that's so basic and so true. Please mm-hmm. do this. All my students, speak the speech after you, trippingly off the top. Like, don't saw the air. Like, that speech. I love it.
Are you gonna tell us your favorite quote? Or are you just going to talk about
the speak the speech speech this aha so it is, and I'll just do a bit of it, but it's the speak the speech monologue that Hamlet gives to the players when they're about to perform. Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you trippingly on the tongue, but if you mouth it as many of our players do, I had as lief the town crier spoke my lines. Nor do not saw the air too much with your hand thus, but use all gently, for in the very torrent, tempest, and, as I may say, whirlwind of your passion, you must acquire and beget a temperance that may give it smoothness.
As you might imagine, with a text so chock-a-block full of poetry, I had many, many lines, both short and long, that I thought were really evocative and powerful. But this, I'm going to go with Hamlet when he said, I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, forgone all custom of exercises, and indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory, this most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire. Why, it appeareth nothing to me but a foul, pestilent congregation of vapors. Hamlet is all of us in 2024.
Yeah. Agreed.
I found that quote to be super relatable. It's also a song in the musical Hair. They turn that I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth. I don't know why it's randomly in the middle of the musical Hair, but it is.
And that's the thing about this play. Like, it's been pulled and plopped in so many other, like, mediums. And
mm-hmm.
it's a little ubiquitous. Yeah. Hot take number four.
All right, so I could see myself directing this play or playing Gertrude, but I tell you what, like, down to the marrow of my bones, more than anything, what I want is to be the editor for this play and fix all the issues, preferably with the ghost of Shakespeare, but on my own, if necessary. Like, really, that is all I want, is to fix the many, many, many problems in this play. Because I feel like what's wrong with this show is not unfixable. It's just like, this is a great first draft. Thank you, Belle. could we just, like,
yeah, it just
fix
needs
these
to be,
you know, these it things.
Desperately needs to be pared down. Yeah.
Yes. What about you? If you were going to work on this show, what production role would you want?
So I played Claudius. I did some scene, in a production called 43 and a Half, The Greatest Deaths in Shakespeare's Tragedies, that I did as part of the Fringe Festival in DC years ago. We did it, we remounted it a couple of times. So we did it like three or four times we performed this. And it was basically the scenes, or it highlighted the scenes of all the deaths in Shakespeare's work. Or 43 and a half of the best deaths in Shakespeare's work, right? My friend Sun King, it was his concept and his idea. And so we performed it, and I got to play Claudius in the scene in Act 5, Scene 2 in Hamlet. But that was really the only scene from Hamlet that we worked on. I would
Where he double dies.
Full production. Yes. But I would love to play Claudius in a full production. I think... It's always fun to play the bad guy too. But yeah, there's just so much there. There's so much. I mean, he isn't just a one-dimensional bad guy either. I mean, he has some depth to him. He has remorse. He has, he has a broad range of feelings. He made some bad choices. Okay. He's not a bad guy. I would love to play Claudius.
I think that, as written, we're not supposed to know Claudius is guilty until Act 3. I mean, that's sort of a problem with the text in that everybody who knows this play, knows Claudius is the bad guy. But he should really come off for the first half of the play like a good guy. So I do think he's a really interesting and complicated figure. I hope this is not the same answer. Hot take number 5, which character in the play is the most like you?
No. Oh my God. Well, no, thankfully, but I'm not sure if it's better because I felt like in a lot of ways, in the melancholy sort of way, I'm very much like Hamlet. He's not quick to act. And I think that is something that we have in common. I think I could probably pull some similarities from other characters, but I started watching a bunch of different versions of this as well. And I could resonate resonate with the character, just that he's just got an emotional depth, but he's also extremely intelligent. And he just doesn't, he's not quick to act. So
I think that Hamlet is actually, he can be quick to act. I think that Hamlet is so smart that he's trying not to do the wrong thing. He's trying to get enough information to do the right thing. And so he's often mischaracterized as not being quick to act. But like once he gets the right information, he's on it.
Yeah, that's me.
Which doesn't always work either. Next time I see that king, I'm totally killing him. Behind the curtain, stab. Oh, crap. Cruddity.
Yeah. What character is most like yourself?
You know, this works out well for the two of us. I think I'm probably the most like Horatio, which is why you and I are BFFs. I think that I think Horatio is always there for the people he cares about and, trying to get them calm, centered, and rational. He's there for his friends, unquestionably. He tries to encourage reason in others. He is really careful with the big feelings of others. He's able to act even when he's afraid. I think my secret fear is that everyone thinks I'm like Polonius, just sort of like rambling on about details in the background. But hopefully I'm most like Horatio.
Excellent. As always, we love to hear your hot takes. Just a reminder that you can post them on our social media pages or send them to us in a voice message for us to play during our Community Voices section.
And now, the section where I test Ricardo to see how well he knows the plot of Hamlet by giving him a quiz about what happens in the show. If you've read the play, you can take the quiz along with us. But if you haven't, this is a great way to get familiar with the story.
Just to set this up for those of you who did not read the play, we are going to set up the goings-on in Hamlet. I was curious, though. I asked ChatGPT if it could give me a summary of the play in iambic pentameter, and this is what I got back. In Elsinore's halls our young Hamlet dwells, a prince entwined in sorrow's darkened spells. A ghost appears, revealing secrets grim, a murdered king by foul Claudius his kin. To vengeance sworn, yet Hamlet's mind, a maze, a tortured soul, lost in a brooding haze. He feigns madness to mask his purpose true. As tragedy unfolds, despair to strew. With soliloquies rich in thought profound, Hamlet's introspection does resound. A timeless play where human nature shone in iambic verse, its brilliance known.
Well, we're all out of a job.
Yeah, I guess that's why all those bot farms listen to the podcast. They're ready to take over for us. Welcome to Read More Plays, the comedy podcast about plays and the artistic process.
I am your host, X27D43.
And I am Ricardo 9000 Delete.
Okay, while we're still here in charge of the podcast, we're going to jump into the quiz. But Ricardo, I have a surprise for you today. The quiz is not a normal quiz.
What?
We are doing a lightning round edition.
Ooh, thank God.
So we've never done this before, but the idea is that we're going to go very quickly. All right, short questions, short answers. And if you don't know the answer, just say pass, rather than like calling a lifeline, and I'll like throw out the answer real fast. So we're going to fly through this.
Okay, I'm ready.
Art thou ready?
I am ready.
Okay. First question. The play opens on the battlements of Elsinore Castle in Denmark, and several guards are very freaked out. What had they been seeing night after night that has them on edge?
They had been seeing the late king's ghost, the late King Hamlet's ghost, peered silently.
Yes. I guess it's correct. A ghost that looks like the king who died recently. Next question. Denmark is on the verge of going to what with its neighboring country, Norway?
I'm going to say going to war.
Yes, that's right. That's why I was laughing so hard.
Dinner, a date, a movie. Wait, they just want to be friends.
Okay. Therapy.
That's what they should have done.
They're going to mediation. Okay. War is correct. King Fortinbras is angry. Next question. Somehow, even though Hamlet was the late king's son, it is his brother, Claudius, who's been crowned as the new king. Who has he just married? Who's the new queen?
It's the old queen, Gertrude.
That's correct. Hamlet's mother. Widow to the king who died less than 2 months ago. Not at all awkward. Good. Next question. Claudius is sending emissaries to the king of Norway's uncle to do what?
I can't remember. Pass.
Okay. The correct answer is to get his nephew, King Fortinbras, in line and not attack Denmark. Next question. Two of the main characters ask the king for permission to go back to college in other countries. The king tells one of them yes and one of them no. Who gets what answer?
He tells Hamlet no. And Laertes, yes?
Correct.
Boom. Phew.
Correct. Laertes is the son of the king's deputy, Polonius, who gets permission to go back to school in France. Hamlet, the king's nephew and Gertrude's son, is denied permission to go back to school in Wittenberg, Germany. Next question. Why is Hamlet depressed and angry at the start of the play?
Because he lost his father recently.
Correct.
His dad died.
His dad died less than 2 months ago, and his mother just married his uncle. Correct. Next question.
Yeah, that did not help.
That is not See, the, that's the right way of to helpful, manage it. Yeah. All right. Next question. Hamlet's best friend Horatio shows up to deliver what startling news?
Horatio tells Hamlet that he saw a ghost, and it looked like his father.
I saw your father yesternight.
I see him too.
Correct.
Where?
Next question. In my mind's eye, Horatio. Yeah, but I saw him on the castle parapet.
Oh, no, look, listen to this. Yo, I saw him for real though.
No, not see, but see. Correct. Next question. As Laertes is saying goodbye to his sister, Ophelia, before heading back to college, what advice does he give her?
He tells her to leave Hamlet alone or to ignore Hamlet's advances.
Mm-hmm. Stop messing around. He's the prince. He cannot marry you. Correct. Next question. As soon as Laertes leaves, Polonius commands his daughter, Ophelia, to do what?
To leave Hamlet alone?
Yes! Same answer!
Oh.
Stop doing it!
Okay. Stop. See, I thought it was a trick question. Dang it, you don't do quiz trick questions.
Stop spending time with Hamlet. He can't marry you. You're going to bring shame upon the family. Good. Next question. When the ghost appears to Hamlet, what alarming information does he share?
Okay, he's like, for real though? Your uncle killed me. You need to avenge me.
Yes, everybody thinks that the king died. He was bitten by a poisonous snake while he was taking a nap in his orchard. So suspicious, all of that. Oh, yeah. But he was, in fact, murdered because his brother poured poison into his ear. And I actually do think the line, "The serpent that did sting thy father's life now wears his crown," is just some grade A phenomenal exposition. He also, and this is important, he lets Hamlet know that he's suffering greatly in purgatory because he didn't get to do like the spiritual cleansing of last rites before he died. So he didn't go straight to heaven. He is suffering. Good, good. Next question. Hamlet decides he needs to investigate this claim because he doesn't know that for sure that this ghost isn't some demon that's trying to trick him to get him to kill his uncle. So he immediately comes up with a foolproof plan. He tells his friends they have to swear not to say a word about this to anyone. But what is his genius way to solve a murder? What's his plan? What's he gonna do?
Pass. Oh, that's right.
He says he's going to start acting crazy. I hereafter shall think it meet to put on an antic disposition. Please don't tell anybody, but I'm going to act crazy. Don't tell anybody what you saw tonight. Don't think it's weird when I start acting crazy. I'm just pretending this is how I'm going to solve this crime.
That's how most crimes are solved. Yeah.
Next question. Polonius sends Rinaldo off to Paris on what mission? In the least helpful scene in the entire play.
Bass.
I bet he wasn't in any version that you saw. I've only seen Rinaldo in one version of Hamlet. Polonius sends Rinaldo off to Paris to spy on his son to see if he's partying and bringing shame upon the family or behaving. That is as close to a trick question as I will get because this scene is always cut. All right, next question. Ophelia, in great distress, tells her father that Hamlet is acting absolutely insane in her closet, leading Polonius to what conclusion?
Polonius believes that he's in love with Ophelia. Hamlet's in love with Ophelia, and that love has driven him mad.
Yes, because her father made her break up with him. And so it is her not talking to him that now has made Hamlet act so crazy. Correct, correct. Next question. Claudius and Gertrude have brought Hamlet's lifelong buddies, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, to Elsinore for what purpose?
To spy on him. To find out what is driving him crazy. Or what seems to be driving him crazy.
I don't think it's to spy on him. I think Gertrude's son is acting crazy. She's like, what do I do? Let's bring his friends. Maybe they can help. Maybe they can figure out what's wrong. So they come to town because their friend is in a mental health crisis. Claudius might be spying. But I think the other three are just trying to help. All right. Next question. The emissaries that were sent to Norway, Cornelius and Voltimon, return with what excellent news?
That they, what did they get into a fight with? Or they were in a battle with Fortinbras and they won?
There was no battle with Fortinbras.
Pass.
They went to talk to Fortinbras' uncle, who is apparently old and infirm, but also somehow still in charge of what the king does. So Fortinbras' uncle has reigned in the fiery king of Norway. There will be no war. Huzzah. Though now Fortinbras is going to go fight with Poland and then he wants permission to march through Denmark's land to go get to Poland. Next question. What does Hamlet know right away as soon as he talks to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern?
That they're spying for the king.
They have no poker face.
Who said, who called, you were called for.
I think I also might be.
Yeah, we were called for.
And yeah. They tell him.
But we love you.
We're here to help. Yeah. We're worried about you,
Hey, buddy.
We love you, my dude. What is wrong? Correct. The king and queen have sent them. Next question. A troupe of touring actors that Hamlet knows from the city show up in Elsinore. Huzzah! Hamlet asks them to perform. A specific play with some extra lines that he's going to write. What is the reason for this request?
Because he wants to watch the king's reaction to the performance to gauge his guilt, mm-hmm. because he's going to try to set him up.
The play that he asks them to perform.
The Murder of Gonzago.
The play that he asks them to perform is The Murder of Gonzago. And he's added some lines so that basically what happened in real life, it's like a lightly fictionalized version of Claudius killing.
Right. What Hamlet's allegedly father. Happened.
So he
in
wants
real
to watch
life.
His
what
reaction.
Allegedly happened.
Right. And he thinks that if Claudius watches this, he'll be able to, Hamlet will be able to tell whether he's guilty or not. So acting crazy and theater are the way this guy is solving the crime. Hashtag CSI Denmark. Next question. Polonius tells the king and queen that he thinks the reason Hamlet's crazy is because he is full of love for Ophelia. So to test this theory, Polonius and Claudius have sent Hamlet to kind of randomly bump into Ophelia so they can watch them together. What happens when Hamlet wanders in?
He's acting crazy still. He pretends, he says that he loves her, then he says that he doesn't. He's very erratic.
Yes, correct. And actually, first, before Ophelia even walks in, he has his whole to be or not to be speech where he talks about, you know, people would kill themselves if they didn't know what for sure what was going to happen after death, and that it's only not knowing what happens after we're dead and if anyone will ever come back that keeps us from killing ourselves, which is a weird thing for somebody to talk about right after seeing the ghost of their dead father. But whatevs. And then Ophelia comes in and he screams at her and tells her to get to a nunnery. Which leads Claudius to assume that it is not a broken heart. Although, why her returning his love letters, which made him scream at her, doesn't reinforce the notion that he's in love with her?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, that's an issue. Like, oh, okay, cool.
Next question. What happened? Oh, he's not upset by her at all. Next question. What happens when the actors perform the scene from The Murder of Gonzago that has someone murdering their relative king by pouring poison in his ear?
The king stands up and screams, "Give me light."
The king rises.
And exits in a huff.
Yes, leaves the theater with much of the court following, which is not good for those actors on stage going, "Oh, crap. We should not listen to Hamlet. We will never perform here again."
We should have hired a real director.
They are
director.
Not getting a good review on Yelp. Speak the speech. That was terrible advice. All right. Next question. Hamlet is convinced that the king is guilty. Claudius murdered his father. But right after he sees Claudius praying by himself in the chapel, and he does not kill him.
He does not kill him because he is praying, and if he kills him while he's praying, he will go to heaven. So he hesitates and exits. And then Claudius is like, "Oh man, my prayer is in. I can't pray. I'm not even able to pray right now." So Hamlet could have gotten away with it right there. End of play. 2 more hours. Everyone else gets 2 more hours of
my
their life.
My prayer bone is broken.
It's just sprained.
I don't think that's how that works, Hamlet, but okay. In this world, if you murder somebody but you say you're sorry, you go straight to heaven. But yes, that is Hamlet's logic. He says it's higher in salary to murder someone and send them right to heaven. But the next time, I will not hesitate. Next time he's doing something he shouldn't be doing, I'll kill him right away. So he'll go straight to hell. Next question. Gertrude and Hamlet have a fight in her room that ends with who being accidentally murdered?
Poor Polonius. Hiding in the curtains. Yeah, Gertrude is like, my gosh, this my son is crazy. Somebody help. And Polonius is like, yeah, somebody help. Somebody help. And then Hamlet kills him through the curtain, not realizing who it is. Thinking, actually, he is hoping maybe that it's Claudius.
Yes, he does not assume there would be any other man alone with his mother in her bedroom late at night. It's a fair bet. His logic was pretty sound. But yes, he did exactly what he said he would do. He would act immediately. So he stabs the person behind the curtain, behind the arras or the arras. And he the assumed Taylor it was Claudius, Swift but tour. It was unfortunately his girlfriend's dad. Bye. Okay. Correct. Next question. The king sends Hamlet to England with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, telling everyone that it's for Hamlet's safety, with a letter for the king of England. But what does the letter for the king of England ask the king to do?
Oh, to kill Hamlet?
Yes.
I did not hear the question.
Please kill my nephew. Love, the king of Denmark. Correct. On the way, Hamlet has now been taken prisoner, sort of, by Claudius's guards, and they're taking him on the boat to go to England. Hamlet sees Fortinbras's army on their way to go fight Poland over this tiny piece of land that everyone agrees is worthless. What does the sight of this army inspire Hamlet to declare?
Pass.
He declares that he is going to be more like Fortinbras from now on and will kill Claudius the second he has the opportunity. They have this whole speech. Oh, I can't even get into it. I call that the toxic masculinity monologue. Okay, next question. Laertes has come back from France with an army demanding vengeance for the murder of his father. Why doesn't he kill Claudius?
Because Claudius tells him that he's innocent. It was Hamlet who did it. Let's work together to take out Hamlet.
Correct. It was me. It was my crazy nephew. Sorry, I tried.
And it. No, sorry.
That's it. Next question. Ophelia has been driven mad by the events of the first three acts of the play. What happens when she is sitting by the river on a low tree branch?
She drowns. She's, the water gets absorbed into her garments and pulls her under the water, and she drowns singing blah, blah, blah.
Yes. So the branch she's sitting on breaks and falls into the water, and she does not appear to realize what's going on. She's singing those songs and her clothes fill up with water, and because women wore like 50 pounds of clothes, and she drowned. Correct. Although a lot of people called this suicide, though there's nothing in the description that sounds like suicide to me. Next question. Hamlet comes back to Denmark. Who does he tell Horatio he was rescued by?
Pirates.
Pirates. Correct. Because that's, it's a very convenient plot device.
That is what was missing from this play, yeah.
Next question. Hamlet and Horatio bump into some clever gravediggers on their way back to Elsinore. They are digging a grave for the newly dead Ophelia. How does Hamlet react when he sees the funeral for his beloved?
He's incensed. I think this is definitely one of the moments where we realize he did really care for her.
He and Laertes get into a big fight over who loved her most. It is the Real Housewives of Elsinore.
The Real Housewives. All right.
Correct. Next question. Back at the castle, a much calmer Hamlet tells Horatio about how he switched the letter that had Claudius asking the King of England to kill Hamlet with a forged letter asking the King of England to do what?
To kill Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Can you imagine? They're just walking off the deck like, what up, England? And they're all like, hey, king. And the king opens the letter. Let's just chop their heads off, okay? Oh, yes. Kill completely, completely innocent Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There's a strong case to be made that Hamlet is a sociopath.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. Claudius and Laertes come up with a scheme to murder Hamlet in a way they will look totally innocent and not upset Gertrude more than the fact that her son is dead, or the general public, both of whom deeply love Hamlet. What's their plan?
They plan to woo Hamlet into a fencing match and poison the tip of one of the rapiers and poke him with it. And if that doesn't work, he will poison a cup of wine to give Hamlet if he makes it through the fencing match.
Correct. That's not going to look suspicious at all.
What could go wrong?
We're now heading into the... What could go wrong? We'll see. Correct. Next question. The first two rounds of the fencing tournament go Hamlet's way. The king goes forward with his backup plan, and he puts this giant pearl in a goblet of wine for Hamlet, and he asks him to drink it. It's so not sus. Hamlet says he'd like to fight sober, and they'll get to the wine in a second. So who instead drinks the poison wine?
So instead, Gertrude, who is so very thirsty, takes a drink. Much to Claudius' dismay.
The queen carouses to thy good fortune.
I will, my lord.
Madam, did not drink! Oh, crap.
It is the poison cup.
Correct.
It is too late.
Next question. It is too late. Laertes gets frustrated with Hamlet winning all these rounds, and he goes ahead and cheats, and he scratches Hamlet with his poison sword when Hamlet's not looking. How does Hamlet react?
He says, ouch. No.
That was in the first draft. Shakespeare scratched out the ouch.
Then they fight. And then Hamlet switches rapiers, or he gets Laertes' rapier.
Yes.
And then he scratches him.
Correct. Hamlet is, not his calmest self these days. So he immediately goes into fight mode with Laertes, and he does get the poison sword and scratches Laertes. He is justly slain with his own sword. Correct. We're almost done. Next question. Gertrude dies, and Laertes says that the king poisoned the cup, prompting Hamlet to do what?
Prompting Hamlet to kill the king, finally.
Hamlet killed. He double kills him because he took so long. Here, I'm going to stab you, and I want you to drink the rest of this poison. And what else can I do? In the Brana version, he drops a chandelier on
him. Oh my God, that was ridiculous.
The Phantom of the Opera defense. Next question. While they are both dying, Hamlet and Laertes forgive each other. Meanwhile, Horatio tries to drink the remaining poison to die with his best friend. What stops him?
There's no poison left. The cup is empty. And Hamlet's like, nah, man, you gotta stay alive so you can tell my story.
You are the only one who knows what happened. If you die, everyone's just gonna be like, what just happened? You gotta stay alive and tell the story. Correct. While Hamlet is dying, Hamlet says who he thinks should be the new king. Who gets his vote?
I believe he says Fortinbras, right?
Correct. He clearly has a big old man crush on Fortinbras. And the final question. Laertes dies, Hamlet dies, and then who comes bursting in?
Fortinbras.
Correct. Fortinbras and the ambassador from the King of England. The ambassador is like, we did what you asked. We killed Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Oh, yeah. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Oh, yikes.
What is this?
Clean up in Castle Six.
And Fortinbras says... That's hilarious. Fortinbras like, This place looks like it needs a king. I have some claim of rights here. And everybody files out to hear Horatio's story. That was it. We just covered the whole plot in our lightning round of a 5+ hour play in what? 20 minutes, maybe?
Maybe 25. Well, probably we'll edit it to 20.
We deserve a cracker. Well done. Virtual high five.
That was awesome. So hopefully the overview and the quiz questions have given you a clear sense of what happens in the show. But if you'd like a more detailed outline of the plot, you can check out the summary of the play that we have in the synopsis section of our website. There's a link to this in the podcast show notes episode description. Now we're going to move on to the analysis section.
Plays were meant to be seen, not read, but before a production is ready to be seen by audiences, even before rehearsals and production meetings begin, the job of the theater artist is to come to a deeper understanding of the text by looking at it through an analytic lens. In this section, we'll get to know this play a little better by talking about it through a single piece of analysis.
This week, we're going to be using a technique called event comprehension, which is a technique that Jennifer is going to walk us through.
The thing about Hamlet and text analysis is that you could literally do any technique and it's going to help you. Philosophical statements? Yes, it's got a few of those. Theatricality? Yes, you'll need to have to map that out. On and on. Like literally anything we have done on this show, you could do analysis for this play. This text is one of the few examples of a text that operates on so many levels that multiple different forms of analysis will really help unlock what's going on in the play. I actually used this play when I was teaching text analysis for the first half of the semester, which Sam can attest to. We did many different kinds of analysis on it week after week while working to get to what we think the play is about. However, if I'm going to just pick one for this episode, I want to talk about event comprehension or event comp. And really, I think this is a particularly important analysis technique to consider when you're doing any play from a different time period where the language functions differently. So all of Shakespeare's plays, all of Marlowe's plays, pretty much anything out of early modern England. But you could do this on any classic text. The idea is that the audience is not going to get everything that is said. The average audience member is not going to hear early modern English language in the same way that they're going to just listen to a contemporary play. In the same way you'd listen to a podcast where you can just follow along with what's saying with even just the barest attention paid. Shakespeare is almost like listening to another language. I know for myself, I've done a lot of work on Shakespeare over the decades, and I still kind of have to have my Shakespeare ear click in. And there's stuff that you'll miss, as there's particularly stuff that you'll miss because the text has all these references to things that everybody in 1591 would have gotten, but not necessarily in 2024. There's all this local stuff that I needed to read the dramaturgy page in my script to know what it was referencing or even know what certain words mean. So when you do event comp, what you do is you boil down the scene that you're working on and come up with the main things you need the audience to know. Okay, this could be like two things, one thing. Act 5, scene 2, maybe 7 things. Like, you boil it down to what the audience needs to get to follow along with the show. And actually, what I did when I was working on this analysis piece was for every act, for every scene, I wrote what I thought was most important. And that's what I turned into the quiz. So everything that we just went through doing the quiz all came out of the event comp work. There were a few things that I left out, a few things that I consolidated, because while it would have been important in the scene, we didn't really need it for the quiz. We just kind of follow along. But this way, you can be sure that the audience follows along the journey, even if they don't get every single reference or statement that every character says. So if people sat through 5 hours or 3 hours or whatever of Hamlet, and they only got the 35 points that we covered in that quiz, they would know what happened in Hamlet. They might not know every reference. They might not get every allegory or allusion, but they would for sure know what happened in Hamlet. So that's why I think it's an important thing to do. Particularly for plays set with a language barrier like an early modern English play.
If you're curious about the techniques that we have used on this or other episodes of the show, you can find more information about them on our website. There's also a link to that in the show notes. And remember, it doesn't matter what techniques you choose, taking the time to comb through a text with a deliberate analytic task will always result in a clearer sense of what that show is about.
All right, it's now dramaturgy time. This is the section where we each share an example of something we learned while doing research on the show. My friend, what did you learn about?
So I was curious. Okay, so Polonius, rest his soul. I really liked the character of Polonius. I know he's, I don't think any of the other characters, except maybe his kids, liked him so much. But I thought he's a very likable character. So digging a little deeper, I realized, or I found that he was based on, partially based on William Cecil, or first Baron Berkeley, who apparently historically was a bit of a dick, or apparently historically was a bit of a bad guy. And, and so it was interesting, one of the actors who I saw in like a PBS special was saying how he at the time was a very despised character. So seeing this character get killed on stage was something that the contemporary audiences of the time would like really loved and were really like cheered for or whatever. But you know, through history, it hasn't really, in the play itself, it doesn't really translate that this guy is someone that, you know, he shouldn't really like, or he isn't likable. He's written as a likable character. So I just thought that was very interesting that, you know, sort of those things that are present, things that were present at the time the play was written, didn't necessarily survive. And the text itself doesn't necessarily support this character being bad. I think Polonius is written as a very sweet man. He's worried about his daughter. He doesn't want her to be, associated with someone who might just use her and then dump her. So I just thought that was really interesting that he was based on a real person who was not really liked by the populace at the time, if that makes sense.
That is really, yes, that's so interesting. I read a really interesting tidbit in the dramaturgy of my text about the character of Polonius. So in the dramaturgy from my text, it says that in the scene where Hamlet and Polonius are getting the play rolling, the play within the play, and they're kind of chatting in front of the court beforehand, Hamlet says, well, Polonius, didn't you used to act back in your university days? And he's like, I did. People said I was a good actor. And he says, what did you do? And he said, oh, I played Julius Caesar. I was killed in the Capitol. And my dramaturgy says that this was sort of like a meta reference, because the actor who played Julius Caesar in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar was probably the same person who first played Polonius.
That's great.
That I love inside jokes like that. There was a movie from the 80s with Richard Dreyfuss and Emilio Estevez called Stakeout. Do you remember that movie?
Yes.
I love that movie. And there's a scene where they're watching an apartment and they're just kind of bored because nobody's in the house. And they're playing this game where they're saying famous movie quotes and the other person's trying to guess what movie it's from. And Emilio Estevez, his character says to the Richard Dreyfuss character, the quote, this was not a boating accident, which was Richard Dreyfuss's line Jaws. From Jaws. But then Richard Dreyfuss is like, I don't know what movie that's from. And he gets distracted because something else happens. So he just says, I don't know that movie. And I always loved that moment. And that to me, that's what that Polonius connection, that Polonius-Julius Caesar connection made me think of.
Fantastic.
So I fell down a bit of a wormhole because I found myself thinking, the king, everybody thinks the king died sleeping in his orchard getting stung by a snake. Now, let's talk about this. First of all, snakes don't just bite sleeping people, usually. Second of all, there would be puncture wounds. It'd be obvious where that came from. But setting all that aside, are there poisonous snakes in Denmark? That was what I first started to think. So, turns out, there are only two species in all of Denmark. There were four, but now two are extinct. So they have the European adder and the grass snake. And the adder is poisonous, but its venom poses little danger to a healthy adult human, though apparently it can be painful. The website I saw said medical attention is recommended. So there's no snakes in Denmark unless the king had some cobra in his orchard zoo or whatever. And I can't super fault Shakespeare for not knowing that there weren't any lethally poisonous snakes in a whole other country, but it still bothers me. And it's the same in the UK. The European adder is the only venomous snake in England. And actually, Hamlet compares Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to adders. So he knew what an adder was. He knew that its bite was poisonous. There are some poisonous mushrooms in Denmark. See? He should have said he fell asleep in the mushroom orchard and one fell into his mouth.
The king always slept with his mouth open. It was bound to happen eventually.
I told him not to sleep under the poison mushroom tree. There are many poisonous snakes in Australia. If they had just said there's something rotten in the state of Tasmania. The top 11 most venomous snakes in the world live in Australia, including the inland taipan, which is 72 times more poisonous than a king cobra, and with the venom of one bite of the inland taipan, you could kill more than 100 human beings.
Wow. See, Shakespeare didn't do his research.
He did not have access to the internet, sadly. I also found out, I did not know this, but platypuses are venomous.
Did not know that.
They can deploy venom from spurs in their legs that is potent enough to kill a dog or a cat. And, this kind of blew my mind, there are venomous birds in the world. The hooded pitohui has a neurotoxin that's in its skin and its feathers that it gets from eating the poisonous coryzane beetles. So if you get scratched by its bill, it'll cause numbness and can even lead to paralysis and death. So there were so many ways that Shakespeare could have had Hamlet Sr. die while taking a nap.
He was lazy. He was a lazy writer.
But none of them were getting poisoned by bitten by a poisonous snake in Denmark. I'll tell you that much.
Well, that's why we suspend our disbelief, I guess. I wonder how many of the groundlings got up and walked out at that moment.
That's why we set this. This I can't.
What?
Can't
even you had this. Me up until this moment.
All right, I'll go with a ghost. But come on, a poisonous snake in Denmark.
Whoa!
You should have had him eating a mushroom or something.
Awesome sauce, thank you. So, if you would like to learn more about the research and analysis that we did for this play, we post all our findings on the Patreon. So if you sign up to be a supporter there, you can see everything we uncovered.
Now that we've gotten familiar with the structure of the play, we get to talk about our reactions to the text and our artistic interpretations of how a play like this could be brought to life for the 12,100th time.
Yeah, it is not done oft enough. Okay.
I was just going to say, I have read that for an actor playing the part of Hamlet, there is more physical exertion doing this play, you know, like a 3 or 4 hour version of this play, than it's the same as doing a full day's shift in a coal mine, like in terms of flat out effort.
I believe it. Yeah, it is a heavy lift for the title character.
I read
character.
That in one of my Shakespeare books.
And I really... Mm-hmm. I said I would want to play Claudius if I ever did this, like real world, but I actually would really love to play Hamlet too. There's so much depth and so much everything that he gets to go through. But yeah, I think I also think, and I agree with this, I was watching what's his name on the same PBS documentary about uncovering
Scott?
Hamlet. No, it wasn't Andrew Scott. It was one with David Tennant. They were talking to a bunch of different actors who played Hamlet. David Tennant, Christopher Plummer. Christopher Plummer said that like Hamlet is the perfect play to do on film because it just really is. Like you have all these soliloquies, so you have all these moments where it should be softer and quieter, and these things that you have to lift on stage. You have to make sure that the person in the back row can hear you. So a lot of these more close moments don't necessarily convey or have the same effect that they would on film. And I kind of dig that. I kind of agree with that.
I agree with that too. I think there's a lot you can do in film that's hard to do on stage in terms of getting information across. So like in the Kenneth Branagh one, as they're talking about preparing for war, and again, with this problem with the language, like maybe people aren't going to understand that they're talking about the armories are going night and day building weapons. They can, they just show it to you. So like, you can see everybody like really highly anxious. I also think there's so much theatricality in Hamlet, like the ghost itself. There's stuff that you can do in film that you wouldn't be able to do in a stage production. But I also think that I think that it can be done really well. I feel like I've watched a lot of Hamlets just because I would show clips from different versions, different film versions and recorded stage versions to my students when I was teaching this over the first half of the semester. We watched many different clips. And in fact, we'd watched the whole version of the Zeffirelli because it's so short because they hacked that sucker to death. And I think that the best Hamlet is the one with Benedict Cumberbatch, the one that they did for at the National Theater, which they'll sometimes show at National Theater Live. I've seen it twice in the theaters because they'll rebroadcast it. And I think that it is so smart in so many ways. And one of the ways that they handled the soliloquy was it was as though, like I'm picturing the very first one that he has when he's at the kind of like the wedding party with Claudius and Gertrude and the whole court. What happened was it wasn't as though everyone froze, but it was if everyone started moving in extreme slow motion and the light changed and the sound changed. So it very much felt like even though he was sitting in a room full of people, what we were getting was his interior thought process. And I thought that was handled beautifully. I think that this does lend itself to the cinematic process, but it was written for the stage, and that often the emotions are so big that it is enough to carry a production, like a stage, a living, breathing in front of you production.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I definitely agree with that. And there are so many more opportunities for imaginative ways to tell those different points in the story. Like, how do you have the ghost visit? How is that revealed? I mean, and it's so much, and it is really so much more fun when it's a live experience.
Agree.
I mean, yes, this play does convert. I think the play does translate well to film, or can translate well to film. But this, there's so many, like, you have the ghost story, you have the family drama, you have the fighting. All of those things are so exciting and so so much more exciting in a live environment. So as much as it translates well to film, it is so much, it is literally palpable in a live environment.
As an actor, one of the things that has always made me more interested in stage work than screen work is you build this arc, this emotional arc. So it's not like you film that scene where Hamlet and Gertrude go through this unbelievable, racking emotional torture, you know, from her perspective and then from his perspective and then from a distant camera and then an up close camera. Like, you don't do it on the third day of shooting. You don't film that scene and then 3 days later film a scene from a totally different part of the play. You know, you don't do something slowly over the course of 6 weeks or 11 weeks or whatever. You got 2 hours and you're doing the whole thing. So all of the emotion and the connection, you can kind of live in that fictional reality and really build in it. That was all I was trying to say.
Okay, gotcha.
When we were talking about stage versus film. I feel like, you know, I obviously have some issues with Hamlet after reading the play and some things that I love about it. But I think one of the big problems that you have to consider with the text is how big the reputation is. People walk in with all kinds of preconceived notions. I mean, I was trying very hard to not have any preconceived notions from the many, many times I've read it and seen it in the past. I was just trying to read it now and analyze it now and think about what I think about it now. And because of that, you lose sight of these characters as real people. Like, Claudius becomes this two-dimensional villain if you're not careful. The people... Like, we were joking about how ridiculous it is that Horatio jumps into, or not Horatio, that Laertes jumps into the grave to hug the body of his sister. And it can seem ridiculous, or it can seem like unbearably painful.
Yeah.
I remember there's a version with Juliet Stevenson and Andrew Scott doing the bedroom scene with Claudius and Gertrude. That was the first time I really thought about what an amazing scene that is for actors to perform. Like, how crazy does something have to get for a mother to suddenly worry that her son might actually cause her harm? How unbelievably traumatic would it be to have your son kill somebody you know in your room right in front of you? I mean, this whole, that scene between Hamlet and Gertrude, the emotions are so ginormous. And I feel like that's the case throughout so much of this play. Thinking about those people on the parapet waiting for the ghost, I think it's really important that the play starts with the ghost. Like, you have to start, a lot of times people, especially in films, will start trying to give you the exposition on what you missed. Like,
yeah,
the king died, this other stuff happened, this is going on. But Shakespeare starts with the ghost for a reason. You are en medias res, which we talked about when we read Fairview. This idea that the action starts in the middle of something really big happening. And I don't know about you, I have definitely been like, peacefully about to drift off to sleep, and then I hear a sound in my house that I can't explain, and suddenly I am awake and full of terror and like, what's going on? Like, and your brain goes, no, it's not a ghost, it's not a burglar, it's just the cat. But like, it would be terrifying to be out at night doing your job and have a ghost show up. That would be terrifying. Like, I think that because there are so many preconceived notions about this show, it's easy to forget all of the very real, very big things these characters are feeling and trying to make it real.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I agree with you. I think, yeah, and like I said, the thing that I liked most about this was sort of its legacy and how big it is. But you're totally right. I think it lends itself to, actually to great scene work, like individual scene work too, if you go into it with that, mm-hmm. if you go into it that within your mind, that these are real serious, deep moments. And then you have all these different opportunities to explore these really human interactions, I think. Really real human interactions. And I do feel like I've seen several different versions of this, and some executed better than others film-wise. I've not seen a full theatrical version of this play. But after this, I feel like I really, really need to. However, like even the thing about going into it with preconceived notions, I feel like I can't possibly go into watch another either film version or theatrical version without preconceived notions now. I've researched it, I've dug into it so deeply that I've also now formed my own ideas or thoughts about the way it should be done. So yeah, I will be looking for that. I don't think it's a terrible thing for audiences to have that. I feel like it's wonderful for audiences to be educated about the work that they're going to see. It's also wonderful for them to go in and be completely, you know, taken on a journey that they have no idea what's going to happen. But the thing about producing a play like this, you can't produce it and believe that an audience will have absolutely no idea what they're going to see. So you have to be very on your game about putting it together, making sure you're telling the story correctly, and highlighting all the beats and the points, like you're talking about in
Event Comp.
Yes. Making sure that all those things are very clear throughout the story and the storytelling, and all of your artists have to be on board with that.
I definitely was feeling, I had a lot of ideas, and some of them contradicted themselves, like, ooh, this could be cool, or it could go this way, or this could happen. The first thing that I was thinking about was how to create the ghost, because just as I think that opening scene, I think the play should begin and create a sense of really freaky,
scare the crap out of it. Yeah,
in the audience
should be scared.
Yeah, like the people on stage are supposed to be scared, and I don't. It can be really difficult to have a go, you know, like an actor walk out, and it's like, oh, that's just another actor.
Not scary,
you know,
at
how
all,
do you make the ghost supernatural? And I once again found myself drawn to the idea of holograms on stage. I think that you can use fog and light and projection, and now that it is an actual technology, I holograms on fog, I mean, that could be so cool. And it could be bigger than life. It could be different from life. It could be very clearly not just an actor with some white powder on his face to make him look like he has less blood in his body. You know, I think that whatever the ghost is, it should be spectacle. It's a real powerful moment of theatricality. And because this play is so enormous, I don't know, like I was like, can we have an orchestra? Can we have a full orchestra playing live music?
Oh my gosh.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
That would be amazing, actually. Like, the underscoring does such a great job of telling the story as well, or supporting the story. That's a great idea. I was thinking, actually.
Thank you.
you just made me think. So I'm here in Madison, and Mark did a show, directed a show.
Mark, who was the guest.
Who's our guest
star? The guest host for Dontrelle Who Kissed the Sea, season 4, episode 3.
Yes, he has directed
Mark H.
He has directed a production of Wine in the Wilderness, and he's incorporated like video elements where they have live, because that play was originally broadcast on television. It was a play, but it was broadcast on television. So conceptually, he incorporated, like, you know, the TV cameras. But there were live images from the TV cameras on the screen. I feel like something like that, where you're seeing the scene of the guys seeing the ghosts. You're seeing the guys, but in on stage.
But not seeing the ghosts.
You don't see the ghosts on screen, but you see the ghosts on stage. And so, like, weaving it in like that, like, there are ways to kind of, and that's kind of scary looking, I think, or at least in my mind. But yeah, something like that. I feel like, you know, we're definitely in a time where we need those kind of bells and whistles, I think, for some contemporary audiences, or elements like that. Although I have seen some Shakespeare plays that, you know, conceptually they don't work when they try to bring it to make it too present. But things like that.
Well, I don't think, I mean, it could be contemporary in terms of the concept, or it could be classical. But I don't think the idea of having lots of bells and whistles is a new concept for this play. I mean, Shakespeare and all of his contemporaries were writing based on what Horace and what Aristotle said about, you know, the six elements of tragedy. The sixth one was spectacle. So everybody knows that. All through the history of theater, academics have known about this importance of spectacle in production as a way to keep audiences super glued to what's happening to the characters on stage. So all of the sword fighting, the ghosts, the play within the play, there's so much that is already going to be high spectacle. So I also love the idea of the orchestra, because live music, you feel it in your body differently than you feel canned music. And it's not that you can't feel music that's been previously recorded, but when there are violins and drums and trumpets, like, it just, your body becomes a canvas. So it's like you're forced to feel the heartbeat of the play.
You literally resonate. So,
yeah. So that's my extra production. Okay, wait, let me just say this one more thing. I do have one more thing. You mentioned that you would like to play Hamlet, and you'd like to play Claudius, but the character of Hamlet speaks to you because of everything that they're talking about and going through. One of the things that is confusing about the play is that Hamlet is referred to again and again as a young person, and he's a college student, so maybe he's 18, maybe he's 20. But then in Act 5, when he bumps into the gravedigger, in order, you know, they say that it takes 23 years for a skull to decompose, and he's got the skull that he's looking at, and he's like, oh, I knew this guy. And so the idea is, they say in that scene that Hamlet is 30. So either Hamlet has been gone for 12 years between Act 3 and Act 5, or there's a really confusing bit about what is his age. So quite often they cast people in their 30s or 40s to play Hamlet, and I think that is a mistake. I think Hamlet is young. He, again and again, they talk about him as a youth, and like, they, that is used to explain why he isn't made the king. That's used to explain why he's going through so many giant erratic emotions. And so while I think Benedict Cumberbatch did an unbelievably brilliant job portraying him, and of course people on stage can play much younger than they are in real life because of the distance between the actors and the audience, I think this is a young man's part. And I also think if Hamlet is 18 or 20, Gertrude would have been married off when she was 15, mm-hmm, or maybe 20. But like, that puts Gertrude at age 40. And I feel like I see these productions where Hamlet is being played by a 40-year-old, and you got like a 65-year-old woman playing Gertrude and a 70-year-old playing Claudius. I think everybody is so much younger than that. I think that Hamlet is 20, Gertrude is 40, you know, Claudius is 45. And I think that changes things when, you know, when these characters are younger and more vibrantly energized and alive. So I do feel like they should stop casting octogenarians to play the ghost of Hamlet, Hamlet's father.
Interesting that you mentioned, I think the play doesn't really specify a lot of time things. There are some things with time that happen that are, you're like, what? Like the when the ghost appears to Hamlet, when Hamlet goes to see the ghost and the ghost leads him off, and he's like, oh, okay, mark me, listen to what I'm trying to tell you, blah, blah, blah. Oh no, the sun's coming up. Like, wait a minute, we just started talking. Like, I just got here.
The clock just struck one when the ghost appeared.
And now the rooster is crowing.
Oh, the sun is coming up. That was driving me crazy. Yeah. And like, I was getting really frustrated because, you know me, I like to go comb through the exposition to get the facts about the show, but the facts are so malleable. So Hamlet says, you know, when in act one, scene two, when he finishes his, you know, oh, that this too solid flesh reflection about his depression, he's talking about his mom getting married to his new husband. And he says, it's been 2 months. He goes, wait, actually it hasn't even been two months.
Yeah.
Right. And then in act three, he says, you know, when the play is going on and the whole, like, me think the lady doth protest too much thing is happening, Hamlet says, you know, he died 2 hours ago. And Ophelia says, no, my lord, it is twice times 2 months. So if we are to believe the exposition, act one, scene two happened just under 2 months from when the king died. And act three, scene two happens 4 months after the king dies, if we can believe the exposition. But who, you know, the exposition tells us Hamlet is 18 and then it tells us he's 30. It tells us the clock struck the clock struck 12, get thee to bed, Francisco. For this relief, much thank. Oh, the clock has struck one. Oh, the sun has come up. All that happens in like a 6 minute scene. The exposition is like a suggestion. I don't know.
It's interesting. Like, I did have a thought about that when I was thinking, oh, well, actually, how would that work? Like, okay, do you do something with lighting to indicate that maybe time is passing differently? Or maybe when he's talking to the ghost, time is moving quicker, or it seems like... I was trying to figure out how you convey that, or you just ignore it. Or do you just ignore it altogether?
You know, there's a TV show with Kiefer Sutherland called Designated Survivor that is set in Washington, D.C. It's not a great show, but one of my best friends, Kara, and I like to watch shows together. Like, she'll watch it and I'll watch it, and then we'll like comment together about it on Facebook. And so we were watching through this show and it was making me crazy because it would show an exterior of the White House and there would be snow on the ground. And then 2 hours later in the show, they'd show an exterior of the Pentagon and the grass was green and the leaves were on the trees. And I was like, what? Like, they just only had certain stock footage from DC. And it was like, there was zero attempt to put an episode all in the right season. And I was going out of my mind. I was so outraged. And she's like, Jennifer, I don't even notice that. And like, even when I pointed it out, she's like, I don't care. So like, there are definitely people who aren't gonna care, who in act one Hamlet is 18, in act five he's 30. I don't, you know, that Horatio and the guards got there at midnight and now it's dawn, but only 6 minutes have passed. But it drove me crazy.
Yeah, suspend that disbelief. Suspend it. Suspend it.
I tried. That's right. I do think that it's easier to willfully suspend your disbelief when all of the information and the plot is coming at you the first time. You have taught this play for 7 weeks, for a decade, and you have read it many times and seen it many times, I wasn't swept up in all of the new emotions. It wasn't a roller coaster ride. It was all technical. So I really was seeing all these problems a lot more this glaringly.
This plot is Swiss cheese.
And finally, to wrap up, we want to talk about what this play is about. The goal with all deep looks into a play is for the artist or theater goer to be able to answer for themselves the question of what they think a play is about. It's where ideas for productions come from, and it's how a play lives on in our hearts and minds after the lights go down at the end of the show. And most importantly, it's where we get our own sense of knowledge about a play rather than taking the thoughts of someone else's, because we all get to decide what a work of art means to us. So this behemoth that we have been talking about, sir, what do you think Hamlet is about?
I think Hamlet is about so much. It's about, I think primarily it's about humanity. It's about action. It's about making choices, probably sometimes bad choices. It's about finding yourself, you know, cornered, and having to fight your way out. What does that look like? It's about history, religion. It is, I think, ultimately a story about life and death. I don't really have a lot to say about what this is about. It's so much. It's.
I was definitely thinking that when I was doing my analysis, like, I'm not thinking at all about what it's about. Yeah. I'm just thinking about all the continuity errors.
It's about 4 hours. No, it's about, like, how long have we...
It's about 4 weeks. It's more than five.
That I'll never get back. And I'm 50 now.
But we'll
I needed this life. Yeah, no, I'll leave it. What is this play about to you?
Well, first, I think this is a play about love. Many kinds of love, but at the center of all of it is love. I think Laertes must love both his sister and his father. It informs his grief and his blind drive for revenge. Hamlet must love Ophelia and his mother and his father, possibly even his uncle. This play is nothing but pride and vanity if the story isn't centered in love. And building on that love, I think this play also shows us how far out of balance we get when we lose the person we love most in the world. This is a play about grief after everyone else has moved on. I think when someone loses the most central person in their life, the world is shocked initially. They're sad and they empathize and they bake casseroles and they post consolation on your social media. But like the world goes on. The world goes on, and yet the person who's lost their person just spins in their grief and doesn't know quite how to function, doesn't feel like they're allowed quite to give full voice to their grief. So they're trapped between what they feel and what the world wishes they would feel. What would be more convenient? They would stop grieving so loudly. I can never read this play without thinking about the fact that Shakespeare lost his son whose name was Hamnet, in Hamnet, who was 11 and passed away in 1596. Now, the Hamlet was first performed somewhere between 1599 and 1601. There's no real way of knowing what, if any, connections there are between the son grieving the death of his father in the play and the loss Shakespeare had to navigate with the death of his son. But as a parent, me personally, as a parent, it is hard not to think that this would have been something that would have broken him apart, wouldn't have broken him apart, and that he was still dealing with a few short years after the loss of his child. So I think in some ways, this is a show about being overwhelmed with emotion and needing to take action, being smart enough to recognize that if you act wrongly, the consequences will be devastating and irreversible. So that need to move at 1,000 miles an hour while also needing to be deliberate and precise and therefore slow, have those two tempos inside yourself while you're navigating grief puts somebody in a place for a lot of mistakes to be made. And I think this is a story about how we don't know how to do right things all by ourselves. I was thinking about this after Hamlet is screaming at Gertrude and she's so devastated, that scene in the bedroom. And as they're in a really horrible communication place, which is also, again, a lot easier to imagine if Hamlet's a teenager screaming at his mom rather than a man in his 30s, the ghost of the father shows up and says, stop talking to your mom that way. Talk to her in a gentle voice. And Hamlet does. We don't always know how to do the right things all by ourselves. Our passions and our broken parts overwhelm us beyond the point of vision sometimes. We need loving, reliable people on our side, helping us figure out what our actions should be, pointing out what we don't see, pointing out when we are not following our own hoped-for code of upright behavior because we don't have that guidance. We are bereft of a beloved's parent mentorship in life. We miss the mark. Finally, I think that Hamlet, throughout this play, asks again and again, why bother living? In his opening scene, Hamlet just says, like, I get that the church says it's sacrilegious to kill ourselves, but why are we doing this? And then, you know, to be or not to be, this very famous, the most famous speech of Shakespeare's probably, life is full of sadness and depression. And then we turn to bones to be tossed around by lowly gravediggers. Like, what's the point? We will be sad so much of the time. There is so much loss. And the play keeps asking again and again, what is the point? What is the point? And I don't think the play answers it. I do, though, find myself wondering if Shakespeare wrote the play as a way to try to answer the questions that he himself was struggling with on that front after the loss of his son. So perhaps this is a story of how when parts of us die, we need to go into the madness and die a little ourselves to come out the other side and start to live again without these great loves of ours. Or at the very least, if you're struggling, create a piece of art and it'll help you get through it.
I like that.
If we shadows have offended, think but this and all is mended. You've been listening to Read More Plays. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to see all our posts related to this and other episodes, as well as post your own comments about Hamlet.
If we offend, it is with our goodwill that you should think we come not to offend, but with goodwill to show our skill. So if you like this episode, we would be so grateful if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. It is the best way for us to reach new listeners, which we really want to do. You can also tell a few friends about us so our theater community can grow.
Come and join the community of incredible people who are supporting us on Patreon. It's where we post bonus content like video clips of extended conversations we've had while recording each episode, what our analysis and research for the show looks like, bloopers from our recording session, which believe me, there are a lot of, and more.
This episode of Read More Plays was produced by me, Ricardo Frederick Evans, Jennifer Sassaman, and Samuel Fitzwater Richard. Our theme music is by the incredible Kaylin Harewood, with additional music by Bob Sassaman.
That's my dad.
Special shout out to Willie Shakes for keeping us all on our toes these last 400 plus years, as well as to all the amazing people who are supporting us on Patreon. We are infinitely grateful for your support.
Our next episode will air in 2 weeks when we will be discussing Fat Ham by James Imes. Until then, I'm Jennifer.
And I'm Ricardo.
Reminding you to speak the speech, I pray you, trippingly on the tongue as I pronounced it.
No, and also
reminding you to read more plays. Do you think after Claudius in the court leaves, the actors are back there and see?
And scene?
Question mark?
Yeah, they're in the dark because he left and took all the light with him.